Thank you for everyone for your patience, and for those of you who are with me since the half an hour ago, discussing with Katie and then Tony about using Joanna's work, particularly the Truth Mandala, in workshops on deep adaptation and our experiences with that. Thank you for waiting for Joanna, but and now, and thank you to Tony, thank you to for Katie for standing in. Without any notice whatsoever. Joanna, hello, and
Hi,
good.
Jim.
Hi, good. How? Where? You're in California, are you? Is it afternoon there?
That's right. That's right. And then it turns out that there's several folks on this call that are near California, California as well, Colorado. Yeah, here.
I
So,
see.
yeah.
We
Where
have
are you?
75 people now.
Overson?
I'm joining you from Greece, and I see people in the UK and so on. So there's everyone who's just for context, Joanna, everyone who's joining joins as a member. They're a member of the Deep Adaptation Forum, which I set up in order to try and deal with the in a useful way with the amount of people who were getting in touch to after my Deep Adaptation paper came out and who wanted to really connect with others and explore questions of collapse and how do we feel and how do we. What do we actually do in, if we feel that some form of societal collapse is either inevitable or likely? And of course, that's how we connected. And I know, Joanna, you and I have been having a couple of conversations over the last months, but I'm really pleased that you agreed to do a Q&A with us today. So welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
So I first discovered your work about 20 years ago, and I used a, I think I used your systems game in my teaching quite often, but I really reconnected with it when, particularly the work around how to hold space for people dealing with difficult emotions, as we sense that we're in the heart of in the middle of a sixth mass extinction, and we feel that the terrifying situation that confronts us. How do we find some sort of both equanimity but also engagement, so not to turn away but turn toward these difficult times? And I felt your book Coming Back to Life really speaks to that. So first up, I'd love any thoughts you could share on how you feel your work is perhaps finding greater relevance and resonance around the world right now, sadly because of growing awareness of our predicament.
Well, because this work sprang out of an awareness of this predicament, but that was 42 years ago. I had been an environmental activist with my family and my teenage children, and we knew a lot. And then it was my son, his freshman year in university, when I visited in Boston, took me to a day, one day, looking at the threats to the biosphere. So this was 77. And there was everything. It was the Cousteau Society. Jacques-Yves Cousteau himself was there, but it was much more than the destruction of the oceans and the pollution and the loss of plankton was a big concern then, but it was the oil spills and the but then it covered all the other things as well. The depredation on the species, the extraction of the deforestation. So this was 42 years ago. And I went from display to display to panel discussions. And this was all information that I was familiar with. I was in my middle 40s then, or late, whatever. I just turned 90, so it's hard for me to figure back that far. But it's about halfway.
Happy
In
birthday for recently.
Nel mezzo del cammin de nostra vita, halfway in the course of our life. Any rate, but there was one thing I saw, and it just tipped it. And on my way back to where I was staying on a train over the bridge, the River Charles, it just suddenly hit me that our species was destroying our world. And that what I saw, which somehow pulled out the scaffolding that had kept all that information as information in my mind, my mental acuity there, and it just cascaded down through my body, my heart, my feelings to my feet. And I thought, we're done. So this was, so the question for me from then was, how do I live in a world that my species live, how can I live so that I am present enough, in full presence, so that I could enjoy it and be useful? Two good questions. While my species is destroying it. And that led to the work that you encountered 20 years ago and a few months ago again. So that it became, evident to me after a year and a half of sort of a dark journey that people did not lack information. And for me to tell people what was happening, particularly the people who were responsible or who were voting, but almost anybody, except a certain diehard activist, but almost anybody else, they would turn away and say, well, there's nothing I can do about it. It is a shame, isn't it? Oh, such a shame, but there's nothing I can do about it. But there was a reluctance to feel mental pain, moral pain. So that was what started the work, and that seemed central. How can we be with discomfort, mental and moral and psychological discomfort? And I didn't like it myself, but I got very curious. And so that went right from the start. We were, because I was teaching meditation at the time as well, began to experiment with how close you could get to the fire. And then we found simple things that we're still using, like open sentences, and much better than questions, that help people. And because I was looking for not to persuade people about how bad things were. That your eyes would just glaze over. That was the one thing they didn't want to hear. They just think, no. So, but they, how could I get the voice from inside them, that's the most voice they most needed to hear, which was a voice of caring? And so that wasn't so hard.
I see. Really does come through in your work. The voice of caring inside them, to connect back with that rather than the fear of the pain that they might experience, that the fear of despair that would keep them away from being conscious, from connecting with their compassion and their benevolence. Joanna, you mentioned meditation. Can I come in on that?
You're welcome.
So you're a Buddhist, and I was wondering.
I don't use that term.
You don't use the term. How would you describe yourself?
I'm a person who loves the teachings and practices of the Buddha.
Right.
But Buddha was not a Buddhist.
Excellent. Thank you.
Take off the labels.
I was wondering how Buddhist philosophy and also Buddhist practices, or either of them, you think, or you're finding helpful for yourself or for other people as we sense this ever greater terror about as this destruction of life on Earth seems to be coming to our own doorstep. When I say our, I'm recognizing the people here on Zoom around the world, probably the educated middle class people, most people living in the West. It's sort of coming home to roost now. And that time. So I was wondering if you're finding Buddhist philosophy or Buddhist practices to be of help in that context.
I did from the beginning.
Okay.
Hugely. What makes it difficult for us coming out of the Western mind, coming out of the and theistic traditions, is that we have see ourselves as separate individuals, basically. And this has grown, of course, extremely strong in the last five centuries of hyper-individualism. So what for me, as a Westerner and an academic and an activist and a professor, and was to not just read about it in books about them, but to working with Buddhist refugees from Tibet in the 60s, I encountered their way of being. And that intrigued me, and I, what I found was that the experience of being a who you are is not put in an isolation cell or a prison cell of being a separate and permanent self or individual. And that is actually, that separateness and permanence is actually a delusion. And it's a delusion created by your appetite for power and praise and aversion. So we've lost our way. Now it's okay if you think of yourself as let me get backtracked. So that right now today we how do we handle such overwhelmingly the world that I need, the world that has brought me forth, or that I am now living on with my family and my job, is coming apart. What'll I do? I'm lost. How can I? So the move that the Buddhists made, and now that you can make with an understanding that our world is alive, that our earth is a living system, that everything we are and know and feel and is part of that earth. If you make a shift, break free of that isolation cell of the separate self, always so greedy for recognition and and so ready to compete. This needing to be right. This separate self falls prey to. I got to find somebody. Who can I blame for this?
Could I just pick up on that one, which is fascinating to me, because you've talked about your work about inviting people into that place of compassion, and you've just said also to one of the ways of coping with a sense of that you're losing control in your life and things are falling away is to blame somebody. Just on that issue. So I find that quite a lot of people who are either concerned about climate change or who are clearly activists on climate change are talking about who to blame. And it may be oil executives, or it may be a whole country that's profligate, or a whole class of people. And I was wondering, What are your thoughts on the, I mean, and also some people say that it's actually strategic or tactical to have someone or to blame. I was wondering what your thoughts are on blame in general, but also where that might come from in terms of your spiritual philosophy and so on. And I'm thinking also, let's make this, why should the, what are your thoughts on whether or not young people should be blaming us for the predicament we've created? So children today who are facing such a terrifying future.
Well, I'm not hearing blame from them. From Greta Thunberg on, by and large, I only hear them wanting us to hear them. They want our ear. Listen to me, they say. Don't turn away. Listen. Care. Please care about this. You've got the levers of power, as she says, to whether she's in Davos or talking to the House of whatever parliaments where she can get out without taking a plane. So I don't see, frankly, I don't get blame from the young ones and the youth and the millennials, because they know that they're, well, I don't know, I can't explain why, but they don't. And I think that the people who are the most susceptible to blaming are the ones who have the smallest and tiniest sense of self, that they are totally identified with their social or economic position and their the votes or voices or that they can harvest. So that the we are called, I've just spent a day with a wisdom keeper of the rainforest in the Amazon, and I have never met a more humble person, and it evokes the humility. Humility is freedom, as far as I'm experiencing again, to go, because you find this in the indigenous people. You don't have to go to the Buddhists. As a matter of fact, I know some Buddhists who are pretty concerned about their rank seniority.
Thank you. I was wondering, the other aspect of blame is self-blame or guilt. And how, if you hear people who feel guilty about this situation and our contribution to it, what's your response?
Yeah, I could say that we're, you know, there again is a focus on the separate self. It could be endless. You can look in the mirror morally from now to doomsday. That is so boring. We've got to graduate from that. We have a planet-wide disaster where we finally step out of your separate self adulation, because self-judgment and self-praise are so equal. You're focused on how great you are. We could just take it off as if we're taking off a suit of armor. Excuse me.
Yeah, no, it's as I feel that way too, and I don't know how to often to say it. Yeah, it's just because I've had a lot of people talk to me about our predicament and all these sorts of things about who to blame or blaming the self and so on. And none of those views seem to lead to compassionate action. So yes, I hear what you're saying very clearly there. Yeah. I'm going to turn it open now, Joanna, to the 80 people who've joined us and invite hopefully Joanna, would you be able to stay with us for another half an hour? Is that possible?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Good. So we'll have half an hour of questions, and of course people who thought this was ending on the hour then obviously duck out, and I'm sorry for the delay in getting started. Matthew, I know you were going to, what I think I'd like to do is actually have a question on hope, and the context for this, Joanna, is I have been criticized for taking away hope by talking about how I believe now that, that a societal collapse is inevitable. And so I know you've done quite a bit of work on hope in the past. Now we have a question on hope from Iwan. And Matthew, if you could unmute Iwan, and we'll hear from Iwan directly on this matter of hope. Have you...
Right, well, I see their face.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Well, lovely to talk to you, Joanna. I was a student of Jiddu Krishnamurti, and he used to say that hope must die. And I wonder how you relate to that.
Well, he's got a point. You say, yeah, I myself, when I wrote the last, co-wrote the last book called Active Hope, my people who'd been with me over the decades couldn't believe I had written anything with the word hope in it, because I had been experiencing and saying and teaching all along that if your attachment to hope takes you out of the present moment. And this is where you can act. You can't act yesterday. You can't act tomorrow or next year. You can act now. Now is this huge, beautiful arena of the present moment. And this is where you can make a difference. And so hope actually takes you out of the present into what you conjecture is gonna happen. So that's why. However, with my co-author, Chris Johnstone, who's living up in Northern Scotland now, and we actually wrote the book by Skype, which is quite a romp. And what we did was combine it with both systems theory and the Buddhist teachings, where what you can do in the moment is you, with your intention to know what you want, what you wish for, what you love. Oh, the program, civilizational program that you want to get behind, even if you feel it's unlikely. But that's where if you want to get behind. And so we linked hope with intention, which is what actually both in both systems and Buddhism happens. And that way we could talk about that's active hope. Active hope is what you can do, right, what you see yourself and choosing to do. It's that great thing we have, which is choice. There are people choosing to be online right at the moment. And those who have a last to choose that they have to go because their babysitter's gone.
Thank you.
Any thoughts on that, Iwan?
Well, yes. Lots. I mean, it feels to me that, you know, there has been a turn of events, that the feeling that it is too late and this draining away of hope, especially, you know, relating to what I do as well, using theater to produce re-enchantment. Actually, this is my work. Because I don't think anything's going to change unless there's a re-enchantment and a love of nature.
Okay.
I mean, just say, the other day I was talking with somebody about this, and I brought up the example or illustration from the Fellowship of the Rings and Frodo going to through Mordor for the ring, and imagining somebody asking him when he's in the hardship working, do you have hope? Are you optimistic about this venture? And he doesn't have time. Get out of here. I don't have time for questions like that. You have to concentrate. So it's not that hope, you're hopeless. You just don't bother talking about hope or nurturing hope if you're looking right at the moment, right at the act you're in the middle of.
That's very clear indeed.
That's my 1 o'clock clock.
Oh, You have a fun clock, more fun than mine. So, yeah, I've started to hear people talking about being hope-free, but other people then talking about a kind of hope which is how we wish to be in the moment, rather than speculating on things we don't really know about. But that also connects, though, to this idea of some strands in spirituality, particularly influenced by the law of attraction concept, think that we need to imagine some positive material future for it to be so. And by not imagining that, we somehow make it so. I was wondering what you say to people like that. I'm thinking also of we hear a lot about the power of vision, the power of a compelling story around the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible, for example. What are your thoughts on those people that say that we need a powerful vision of a better material future?
Well, I think it's a very unfortunate example of magical thinking. That your thinking of something makes it so. And I haven't myself found that persuasive or useful in my life.
Mm.
So I think that being willing to be with what is. I was having a hard time at last fall over I was actually went to a facility. Oh, I'm talking too much. Let's bring on the
next question. Okay, sure. We're going to ask, there's a question from Linda. And by the way, please do put questions. If you're ready to ask questions of Joanna, put them in the chat box. Also, it'd be good to get a mix of men and women asking questions. Linda, you're asking a question about if it's to do with being a speaker and a teacher on this topic and how difficult it is to find something to say in these desperate times. Over to Linda. Matthew, if you could unmute Linda.
I think I am unmuted, but thank you. Yes, hi, Joanna. Thank you so much for today. I podcast, and ironically, as the reluctant evolutionary at Voice of Evolution Radio, and I wrote a radio drama series about why the world is where it is as an imaginary character giving a kind of, not advice, but sharing an open-handed offering to humanity about where we are and how we got here today. And after I wrote that, I found that I didn't know what else to say, that I haven't really podcast in a very long time. And I'm, you know, how do we be with all we know and find compassion for our own reluctance, because I have to raise my hand as a reluctant evolutionary myself. And how do we use our voices in combination, an urgency and humanity? I'll add to it that I'm also, I became certified as a forest therapy guide so that I could reconnect people to the more than human world and make it personal again. Because I know that if something is personal, we care about it and we want to protect it. And we have categorized it as an object so that we see it as outside of ourselves right now. I have so much trouble today finding my own voice in this, being a voice for the voiceless, and I can't find my own voice. And so I'm wondering if you might have some thoughts about that.
Well, I think this can be a very fruitful situation. I think that's then, give yourself a break from your own voice. There's so many people who are shooting off their opinions. How do you know what's your own voice? But you can let other parts of you speak. You can let your taste buds speak, or your feelings of your heart speak. Oh, this is good. Oh, this scares me. I think it's a sign. We were just talking about this man from the rainforest, this teacher. He was so humble. He was so humble, and you can write stories, or you can ask questions. You can turn from not having your voice to having being of this blessed state of curiosity and inviting people to speak how they see the world. What scares them? What worries them? What do they love? Our first question at a climate emergency meeting a week or two ago, I did an open sentence, which was, as I face collapse of our culture, what I'm grateful for is. That's a wonderful question. Try it.
That's a brilliant. It's really powerful for me to hear that as well, Joanna. In the sense of, and it's a difficult thing to do, isn't it? When suddenly everybody wants someone with the answers. Everyone wants someone to give them a pep talk. And
you know what? Excuse me. They don't want it. They don't want your answer. Basically, they ask as if they want. But what they, in their deepest heart, they want to hear the voice inside them.
Yes, very beautifully put. I had an experience recently at a camp where after a Q&A, which was set up well, therefore I was an expert on this topic of societal collapse and how we live with that anticipation. There were parents of young children, and they were particularly troubled by this. And I have no answers, and no answers at all about. But so the only answer was simply to offer a space, and Katie and another camp member, they just hosted the space, and it was an invitation for people to share their emotions with no answers. It's just to be with the pain and to witness each other's pain and honor that. It's like, say, it is the way to be in this predicament. There's no way out of it. We have to be there with that pain and then find community, find something else on the back of that sharing.
You are a brave man. And that is exactly what I find so admirable and so persuasive. That true humility of yours is what caused me to believe right off the bat, here is someone that I want to read and learn from. Mm-hmm. You are entirely there. You're not trying to sell anything. You're not even trying to sell your own brilliance, or you're not trying to sell humility. You're not trying, you're just putting it, you're joining people. You're paying them the great compliment, the great honor of being intellectually naked or emotionally available before. And I think that this allows, excuse me for preaching, I tend to preach, but this allows Gaia consciousness to speak through you, or any of us who get our separate competitive self out of the way.
Thank you, Joanna. And you've spoken to my higher self. I know I fall away from that. I get busy. I fall back into ego stories of doing and responsibility and contribution and then I become imbalanced in my personal life, and all the nonsense that goes on in me too. But that was wonderful to hear. Thank you very much, and bless you. I've seen quite a few questions are now coming into the chat box. Wow. I'm going to go to Becca. Becca, who's got a question here. Matthew, if you could unmute Becca.
Hey, Joanna. Thank you once again. And I would love to hear if you have any advice on what is the best way to come to terms on the spiritual level with ours and the planet's demise. I'm just curious to know what your reflections have been on. Do you think this is a part of our collective soul's evolution? Is this supposed to be how things unfold? Because it's so hard to accept the loss and suffering, but is this maybe just some form loss of form we are facing? I guess what I'm coming up against a lot at the moment is really dealing with people's existential crisis and grief around what's happening. And I'm trying to understand the best way to support them through their own coming to terms with what is.
we've been given this beautiful life, this beautiful planet. If you let yourself really love it, if you let yourself be open to what the ancient ones and the indigenous people and the contemporary science, this is a living planet. You can find that you can grow in your life in widening circles that reach out across the world. You're that big. We're liberated from that little prison cell of the ego. And then when you're in widening circles, you see pain. Oh, yes, you do. But you see also the beauty of this planet out of which we grow. Then we aren't coming out. I don't believe we're coming from anywhere else. We weren't manufactured. We're not coming out of a laboratory, but even that would be coming out of. So that this, we can plumb and just turn to, again, our gratitude for life and for the love of this. And when we see, oh my God, things are going to be bad, then you say, well, how can we, you see, what's falling apart is a demented system. It is a system, a political economic system of the industrial growth society, corporate capitalism and its guises in countries that don't like to use the word capitalism, but they are commodifying our mother. They're breaking her up and eating, devouring that. So this needs to be destroyed. This needs to come apart, not be destroyed, but it's, and so we look at this, how can we love this world as this demented and destructive political economy dies? We go into a system, what we call in systems thinking, positive disintegration. This happens actually at every stage of the evolutionary, as we evolve from one level of evolution to another. The old codes, the old appetites, the old fears have to come apart. The armor has to be taken off so that the soft, sensitive skin and fingertips, so that the vulnerable parts, eyes and lips and ears, can grow, so that we can grow in connection. It's only to connect. We grow and learn in connection. And the industrial growth society forgot about that, because you can't build connection in a factory.
Can I just come in on that, Joanna?
Yeah.
You're pointing to, well, some people tell me that actually, why do I sound so gloomy or terrified about collapse? If it's the collapse of industrial consumer growth society, which has been so abusive, not only to nature, but to our nature and to us as nature, then why be so doom and gloom about it? And I think, well, because it's going to be quite a lot of pain along the way, and maybe people dying young and so on. So yeah, what's your response to the people who say, oh, let's just welcome collapse. It's about time.
Well, I can see their point, but we can't just say toss it all. So we can try to make what I was hearing already in the 90s, as more and more people were recognizing the mortality or the short-livedness of this corporate capitalism, that we need to bring it to a soft landing. Let's not, and that was even back then contemplated that we could. But now, but that's still, so we we try to acquaint people so that with the necessity of this, maybe, so that they don't blame each other. It's the blaming the system. Otherwise, they turn that this is all because of Trump or all because of the Mexicans trying to get into the States, or, you know, we blame each other. That's pointless. We've all made a huge mistake.
Yeah. So there's that sense of, unfortunately, we humans could make a bad situation worse rather than learn from it and have this as a rather tough invitation to awakening. And for me, I think I don't believe in any story that this means that all of humanity will awaken to peace and love and understanding, but many of us will, and we can be actively seeking to do that ourselves and be part of that ourselves. I think that's what you were saying as well. I'd like to call on Azul, who's with Tony in Totnes. Azul, you have a question, and I think it's...
Let me see Azul's face.
Okay, so Azul, can you... Matthew, can you look for Tony? Look for Tony and unmute. Hello. Tony, and Azul is there.
Bonsoir, Joanna. It's fine.
You're on.
Hi.
Yes, hello, we can hear you.
Yes, hi. Hi, Joanna. Hi, everyone.
Hi,
Joanna, I have a question, which is... actually, I might have changed the question. Originally, my question was, if you were speaking from the river, what would you say to us? But I remember that you have a tree outside the window that you love very much. So perhaps, perhaps you could... we could change the river to the tree, whatever you choose.
Thank you.
No, I was thinking, that last sonnet of Rilke's that I love so much. And he says, and if the world has ceased to hear you, say to the rushing, no, say to the silent earth, I flow, and to the rushing water, speak, I am. So we experience our interexistence. I had a wonderful revelation at the Dart River near you, where a wonderful swan spoke to me. the year my husband died. We have the earth is alive, as you know. We can awaken to that, and awaken that the earth holds us. The poets know that. The early, our ancestors knew that. The early ones know that. And to be with our mother as she's suffering, do we not want, could anything be sweeter than to be with her in this hard time? Do you look at your watch, say, I can't bear it, I don't have time to be with the suffering of my mother? Mm. We discover our love all over again. Music's wonderful. Rushing rivers are wonderful. Poetry's wonderful. Looking at two poets right there.
Thank you, Joanna. I'm loving the reaction on faces around the world through this digital system. I'm seeing faces with tears of joy. So I wonder, I don't know quite how to ask this question. You just turned 90, and I was wondering, as death becomes less of an abstract thing in your own life, in terms of your own mortality, as it becomes something that might be more imminent. I mean, who knows? I might die tomorrow, but it there's a sense that it may be more imminent now. How is that, if anything, changing your outlook, if at all? Can we learn anything from that in terms of as we fear our own mortality, as we look at what's happening with climate change and the potential for a breakdown in our own way of life?
I don't fear it. I want to stay around as long as I can keep up with what's happening. I think this is the most exquisite moment on Earth. I think the conversation we're having now is the conversation we all need to have. We all need to fall in love again with what is. And what is an exquisite planet with wonderful arts and great species. And we have a chance to move together and not blow ourselves up and not kill ourselves with these misplaced fears. I just received a painting that I look at. And it's a painting from a friend I've never seen because he's on death row at this San Quentin prison. And he painted a woods, like a woods you go through, like Dante found himself in the woods in the middle of his life. And then in the woods, he has in the distance, his name is Orlando, and he painted a window. And the window is open, and there's a white bird flying through, like, and I saw it as an angel of death first, but, and you look through the window and there are fields and oceans and waters beyond. And I saw, oh, that's my death. He's painting my death. So I just find it, you know, Jim, I think at Buddha fields around the universe, people are lining up to be born on Earth right now, to be here now, because this is a moment of such exquisite realization. And that's why I love you so much, because you are helping people realize what it's like to be, show what a human can be at this time. So I look at that picture from San Quentin, that man that I said, oh, that's my death, but I'm going to stay here in the shrubbery for a while longer, as long
Excellent.
As I can.
Thank you for answering that. And wow, I just can only hope that I'm for me, I'm new to this path, Joanna. I had sort of a positive disintegration of self about a year ago, and decided to not do that quietly, and still experiencing the consequences of that. But it's been wonderful to connect with what is most important in life. And you've spoken to that very clearly over the past hour, and so much so just in reflecting on that last question. So thank you very, very much. And I'm going to call it to a close now because we've overrun. So thank you, everyone around the world, for tuning in and also for dealing with the technical issues with your patience. Thank you. Joanna, wonderful to connect to not just your words, but that sense of passion and divine inspiration behind the words. It's wonderful indeed. So I really feel blessed to have been chatting with you today.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for this hour.